From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, our series on agriculture in Wisconsin looks at how consumer trends are changing the grocery business.
Now that Amazon is with Whole Foods, that in itself is going to create a lot of disruption in the market, not so much for what they do, but how they psychologically affect the competitors.
Then we catch up with comedian Michael Ian Black, who's in town Sunday evening to close out the Milwaukee Comedy Festival.
I don't know what's funny most of the time. Everything strikes me as a little bit off-kilter, which makes me think I must be the one that's off-kilter. I'm perpetually in a state of making observations to myself about things that just don't translate to the world.
Radio Chipstone remembers the Milwaukee riot of 1967, and we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Earlier this summer, the owners of a longtime staple on the Wisconsin produce scene announced they will shut their doors for good at the end of September. Brennan's Markets operated 5 stores around Wisconsin, including in Brookfield and Oconomowoc.
We wondered if the closing of the 75-year-old business means that the specialized grocery store is going the way of the dodo bird. Well, not so, says grocery retail analyst David Livingston.
That was probably more of a business operations issue. Brennan's was a small retailer compared to the large multi-billion-dollar retailers that we have today.
So do you see there's no room for the small operators anymore, even in a place like southeastern Wisconsin?
Well, there's always room for a small operator, but they have to be well operated. They need, in this day and age, you really need to be debt free. You have to offer something very compelling and different than the other competitors to get customers in your doors.
Does the fact that someplace like, say, Fresh Thyme or Whole Foods, which also offers organic produce and farm-to-store produce, the fact that they are a one-stop shop, is that to their advantage?
Well, I wouldn't say they're a one-stop shop. I think we are getting away from the one-stop shop supermarket trips. People are making multiple stops, going to Trader Joe's, perhaps Fresh Thyme, Sendix, Metro Market, Walmart, Aldi. There's not a lot of loyalty anymore in the grocery business, and shopping patterns have changed.
So what were they and what are they changing to?
Well, historically, people went to a conventional supermarket, did probably 80% of their shopping there, and over the years, stores became more specialized. Extreme low prices, quality and service, fresh produce, fresh perishables, perhaps a restaurant experience, and now we're getting into home delivery and online shopping.
Do you see this as more of a European-type trend where people go to the bakery to get their bread and go to the fishmonger to get their fish? Are we moving in that direction, or is there still room for the big stores?
There's always going to be room for the big stores, but they've got to be very compelling and offer the customer a reason to come in. They can't be too high priced. They can't be, you know, slow in their service. They have to offer the customer a good reason to come. There's going to be a lot of conventional supermarkets, I believe, over the next 5 years go bankrupt and consolidate, and there's going to be a lot of store closings as we see more of the specialty stores open up.
So the idea that if I want to get fresh fish or I want to get meat or I want to get just produce, it seems like things are fracturing into those kinds of specialty stores?
Yeah, it is. And you mentioned earlier about the European style of shopping. A lot of the European style of shopping is influenced by the transportation, the price of gasoline. We don't have that issue here. We've got a good road grid. Our public transportation isn't that good, so people do have to rely on their own. Gas is cheap, so it's easy for people to drive around and shop. We're going to see probably more people making multiple trips. You know, maybe they might buy a bulk of their groceries at a store like Woodman's or Walmart, where it's going to be very low priced, or Aldi. And then we're going to see people start making specialty purchases, bakery, deli, sushi, meat and produce, and they're going to hit all the small specialty stores that have been popping up. And particularly diets have changed. People are trying to eat more healthy. And the private label of organic products is becoming more important. So we're going to see probably more stores open that specialize in these things. And we're going to see some of these stores fail. And already we're starting to see store closures and the weaker aspects of these specialty markets.
Like what? Who isn't making it right now?
Well, I think the Fresh Market, they've got two stores in the metro area. They've been closing stores around the country, haven't been making it. I'm not real sure about Fresh Thyme long term. They've been building a lot of stores. From what I see, for the most part, they're not performing all that well. They just announced a closing this past week down in Kentucky. So I think somewhere down the road, they're going to have to face some challenges and decide, you know, is their business model going to work? Their answer has been to just build more stores that with mediocre performance. So that's generally not a good long-term strategy.
Not usually, no.
Yeah.
What about areas of the country? Does Wisconsin, the trends here in Wisconsin that you're seeing, do they echo across the country, or are we looking at different things happening in different parts of the country?
They do echo overall. We happen to be currently in a state of being overstored, and that's going to work itself out. We've had Meijer come in, open a lot of stores, which has overstored the market. I think they originally thought that when they came in, Roundy's would just go bankrupt and disappear. But instead, Roundy's was bought by Kroger. So the number of closures that they anticipated haven't been there. Yeah, there's been a lot of pick and save closures, but I think Meijer was probably anticipating a lot more of them. They were probably hoping that the stores would fall in the hands of inept operators and maybe the stores wouldn't close, but the sales would certainly go down. Kroger, being a very formidable competitor, has made it very challenging for Meijer. Sendix thinks out of the box. They're opening stores various sizes in unusual locations, and a lot of us didn't expect that, see that to happen.
Going back to where we started with, like, the closing of Brennan, so you think that was more of an operational thing. You don't see that kind of specialty store is going to fall by the wayside anytime soon.
No. That's the type of format that's been growing, and I think we're probably going to see a few more specialty stores like that close, and that's mostly because of being an overstored market or about being highly in debt or having a poor location. But overall, we're seeing a strong growth in the natural, organic, and the fresh perishable stores.
So in the next 5 years, say, what do you think that the grocery store, specialty store map is going to look like here in the Metro Milwaukee area?
Well, first, I think you're probably going to see a lot more pick-and-save stores close that are redundant. It's not necessarily a bad thing. Most of these stores are close to another one, so no one is going to be too inconvenienced. We're probably going to see stores like Whole Foods, Trader Joe's probably expand, find more locations. Now that Amazon is with Whole Foods, it's really unknown. I think that in itself is going to create a lot of disruption in the market, not so much for what they do, but how they psychologically affect the competitors. A lot of the competitors think, well, gee, Amazon and Whole Foods, they must know something we don't, so let's go out and scramble and try to maybe copycat what they do. And maybe that's not the best idea. I mean, if the New England Patriots suddenly said, we're going to start punting on third down, are you going to take your football team and start strategizing third down punt plays? And maybe that's not the right thing to do. But if someone else says it and they're very credible, you tend to believe what they say.
Right. It tends to influence what people do and how the market reacts, because you think, well, this is successful, we should do that too.
Right. And we saw Kroger, they bought a chain called Lucky's, which is similar to Fresh Thyme. And they only had 19 stores, so you can't go too wrong with 19 stores with that type of acquisition. But perhaps down the road, we may see a company like Target perhaps purchase a Fresh Thyme, or maybe Meijer get more involved with Fresh Thyme than they are now. We might see Kroger try to purchase a specialty operator in the area. I'm not sure what's going to happen to the Fresh Market. My hunch is now that they're owned by private equity, they'll probably close. So there's going to be a lot of musical chairs. In the end, it all works out. sales per square foot eventually gets back to a normal level. But in 5 years, I think we're probably going to see a lot more online shopping. I think we're going to see more click and collect. We're going to see more home delivery. I've got a daughter who does the Walmart click and collect because she doesn't want to take her children inside Walmart when they're small children. It's very difficult getting them in and out of the car. And it's very easy to sit at home and just buy things online and then pull up to the store, pick it up, and take it home.
And no matter what, we all still have to eat. So this market is not going to go away. It's just what it's going to look like.
Right. And I think we're going to see more meal kits. We're going to see more restaurant options in the supermarkets. Other parts of the country, well, even over in Madison with Hy-Vee, they've got an extremely nice restaurant option. You've got sit-down dining. You've got salad bars. You've got buffets. You've got pizza. You've got sandwiches. And a lot of people, when they want to go out for dinner, sometimes the supermarket is their first option.
So in all of this, do you see these chains, because a lot of these stores are chains, are they going to be buying directly from farmers here in southeastern Wisconsin or in Wisconsin in general? Do they already do that, or are they still doing national distribution?
In reality, it's natural distribution. Of course, all grocers are buying something local. More of it's hype for advertising. I still can't find Door County cherries in a supermarket here in Milwaukee. They seem to all come from Washington. And I think even if you shop at a supermarket in Door County, you're going to see Washington cherries. But the buying local, that tends to be more hype than anything. There's always a little bit going on, but it's never significant. It's all about the dollars. It's all about the costs. So in the end, the bigger chains are going to be buying, you know, a lot of foreign produce. You're going to see a lot of stickers with country of origin that say Mexico on it.
Chile.
Right. Yeah. And that's just the way it is.
So if you want something local, you need to go to a farmer's market or a farm.
I would suggest doing that because you're going to be picking through a lot of produce in the supermarkets trying to find something local.
Well, David Livingston, thank you so much for stopping in and talking with us. I appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Nice to be here.
David Livingston is a grocery retail analyst. His Wisconsin-based company is called DJL Research. You can hear all of the segments in our Full Plate series at WUWM.com.
Coming up next, comedian Michael Ian Black closes the Milwaukee Comedy Fest on Sunday evening. We'll hear from him next when Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
California, Arizona, I've worked on your crumbs.
We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. If you love comedy, it is a great weekend to be in town. It's the 12th anniversary of the Milwaukee Comedy Festival. And if you're a fan of the wet, hot American summer film and Netflix series, well, it gets even better. Not only did the new season just start streaming, but one of its stars, Michael Ian Black, will close the festival on Sunday.
Black is perhaps best known for his iconic work on MTV's The State, Stella, and as a commentator on the popular I Love the 80s, 90s, etc. series. And in addition to Wet Hot American Summer, he's currently in TV Land's The Gaffigan Show and Comedy Central's Another Period. And if that weren't enough, Black is also a prolific writer, director, producer, and podcaster.
But despite having over 20 years of experience as a comedian, Black is relatively new to the world of stand-up. He took it on as a challenge to himself more recently, though, and now has three comedy specials. Here's a clip from his most recent called Noted Expert.
I had to learn how to speak my wife's language because she only speaks in Zen riddles. Like the riddles that Zen masters give to their disciples, that's how my wife speaks to me. You know, like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? That's like a good example of like a Zen riddle. I don't know what the answer to that is, and I don't want to think about it. Here's an example of a Zen riddle that my wife gave to me. We're eating dinner. We finish dinner, push back from the table. My wife turns to me and says, "Why did you let me eat so much?" And when she said that, I knew there was no good answer to that question.
Michael Ian Black recently spoke with WUWM's Rachel Owens and Milwaukee Comedy's Matt Kemple about his past experiences in Milwaukee and why he decided to focus on stand-up.
I've been a huge fan of yours from the years of The State and everything you've done since. I absolutely love your sense of humor. You are an intelligent guy, but a lot of your humor, if you don't mind me saying, is sort of dumb.
Dumb?
Yeah. And that's what I really love about it is you can take a funny situation and you can heighten it and bring it to the point of absurdity. And I'm just a little curious about what your writing process is like and, you know, how some of those ideas come about.
Well, there's a lot of gnashing of teeth. There's a lot of writing down half-baked notions, trying them out on stage, in the case of stand-up, having them fail miserably, and then starting over again. It's a lot of trial and error. One of the funny things is that I don't know what's funny most of the time. Everything strikes me as a little bit off-kilter, which makes me think I must be the one that's off-kilter. And so I feel like I'm perpetually in a state of making observations to myself about things that just don't translate to the world. And so it's a constant source of struggle and creativity to refine those things to a place where the thing that I'm trying to articulate is something that people are understanding and hopefully recognizing.
Your stand-up career is fairly new as far as your comedy path.
You know,
what kind of led you to starting the path of stand-up comedy versus, you know, all the other projects you've done?
It was a combination of factors. The first was a deep admiration for the craft of stand-up comedy. And the second was a deep fear of performing stand-up comedy myself. And the third, the thing that tipped me over, was that I started getting offers to do stand-up comedy for money. And because I like money above all else, I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, now would be the time to dive in. And so, almost as a challenge to myself, I started doing it. And I've enjoyed it a lot.
And it's interesting because stand-up is so different from a sketch environment. You have a huge group of people that you're collaborating with, and with stand-up, you're just kind of up there having to do your thing. And like you say, a lot of times it fails miserably, but then
you learn from that. I did not mean to imply.
I meant my stand-up career.
Oh, your stand-up is terrible.
Oh, yeah. It's the worst. Is the writing for stand-up a lot different process for you versus like when you're working on a movie like Wet Hot American Summer or sketches with Stella?
Is it different? It is and it isn't. It's different in the sense that obviously the presentation is different. The tempo is different. The way things are framed are different. But underneath it, the architecture is essentially the same. You're trying to create a premise and then explore the premise and take people along a ride and be constantly trying to surprise them, because that's where the joke is the surprise. So, yeah, they're different, but at their base, I would say they probably have more in common than what separates them.
And something I found really interesting, you say that writing books for kids of a younger age is not that much different from writing sketch comedy. So I'd love you to talk a little bit more about that, where you think that crossover is.
It's a one-to-one. I mean, to me, they're nearly identical. A good children's book, at least what I like in a children's book, and I'm specifically talking about the kind of fun, funny books that I write that really have no educational merit whatsoever. It's the exact same thing. So an example is, one of my books is called A Pig Parade is a Terrible Idea. So that's the premise right there. If you're thinking about holding a pig parade, let me enumerate all the reasons why it's a terrible idea. So there's the premise, and then I just explore the concept in the book. And they're similar to a sketch because they're short form. They have a kind of quick setup and a quick beginning, middle, and hopefully a satisfactory ending. Those are the exact same ingredients that you have in a sketch.
I was listening to the WTF podcast with Marc Maron that you did most recently. At first, he didn't really take you seriously as a stand-up, thinking this guy's coming from TV. He's got all that kind of background. What is he doing coming into our world? Do you feel like it's that much of a difference, really? Because it seems like writing has always been, in one way or another, at the core of your career. Or do you really feel like it has been something you've had to kind of work into?
Both. Writing has been at the core of my career, and learning to write for stand-up has been something that I've had to learn to work into. And, by the way, still very much learning. I'm constantly trying to refine who I am as a stand-up. I think it's a question that every stand-up struggles with. What is my distinct point of view that makes me different from every other stand-up that's out there? How is the joke that I'm telling a joke that only I could tell? That's, to me, the critical question for when I'm watching stand-up, whether I respond to the person I'm watching. Does this material feel unique to that person, or is this something that I could see half a dozen other comics do? And that's what I respond to as an audience member, and it's what I try to bring to my own work.
So what really makes you laugh? What kinds of movies or other comics do you just have that level of respect for that humor?
One of the unfortunate byproducts of being a stand-up or a comedian in general is that you stop laughing at things. What I think replaces it instead is a kind of deep appreciation for the craft of what you're seeing. So there's a lot of people in comedy that I have that appreciation for. The first one that comes to mind is Will Ferrell, who always makes me laugh, mostly just because of his just fierce and sincere commitment to whatever stupid thing he's doing. And he just does the stupidest things with such sincerity that it really, really pleases me. I'm just a fan of the unexpected twist and going the place that I never expected to go. Any performer who can do that for me, I just really admire.
I mean, that's what's incredible about your work is
you've been able
to accomplish
that.
That
is what is incredible about me,
It is incredible. Like, one thing that's fascinating to me is over the years, you've worked with Michael Showalter and David Waite on a number of different projects, and it would be easy for different comedy teams to basically just keep recreating the same show and give it different names, but that's not really what you guys have done. You have these distinct projects that you work on, and each one is absurd and ridiculous and kind of stupid, but brilliant and funny and amazing in different ways. Working with those people, is it something that just it's so easy to bounce ideas off of, and you have a similar sense of humor, or was it something else?
With those two guys specifically, it was a direct result of just working on the show that you mentioned, The State, together. That was a sketch comedy group that we founded, group of us of 11, founded in college. We went on to have our own television show on MTV. And we all worked really well together. I mean, when we weren't tearing each other's throats out. But the specific collaboration of myself, Michael Showalter, and David Waite came about more or less as a function of geography. Because after The State ended, a lot of us ended up going to Los Angeles, and me, Michael, and David were, for a while, the only guys kind of left in New York. And so we created a night of stand-up together called Stella, which eventually became its own television show and its own kind of brand. And they wrote Wet Hot American Summer together, a movie that I was in. And we've done various projects throughout the years. But it really started more or less as a function of geography. In terms of whether it is easy or to work with people that you've had a long relationship with, obviously, yes, in some ways, because we do have a extended shorthand that goes back 20, 25 years. On the other hand, there are ways that each of us have grown and our interests have shifted over the years that it can make it remarkably difficult at times to collaborate because our own senses of humor have diverged somewhat. And so just as I'm sort of always refining who I am as a stand-up, I think that collaboration is always refining itself in terms of where the overlap in terms of sensibility, where does that sensibility remain?
Do you ever have moments where it feels stale?
Yeah, I wouldn't say stale, because if something feels stale, it feels like a problem that can be solved. If something doesn't feel fresh, it feels like, okay, that's a moment, or that's a scene, or that's a character, or that's whatever, that needs to be taken in a different direction. What's difficult is agreeing on what direction or what the solution to that problem is. And, you know, we're forever banging our own heads against the wall and banging each other's heads into the wall to try to find those solutions. I think the thing that has always sustained not only the three of us, but the larger group of 11 called The State, is the impetus and desire to make each other laugh. And if we can do that, I think we all trust that we're on the right path.
Interesting what you're talking about, sensibility, because you were speaking again with Mark Maron in that podcast about how you enjoy finding the line between the character that you play on stage and who you really are. You're perhaps becoming more comfortable with the real you being on stage, yet you still want to keep a little bit of mystery up there about where that line may be, where that line blurs. But what's interesting is you're such a great writer. And when I heard, for example, your essay on This American Life telling the story about when your father passed away, things like that are just so real and visceral. You're putting it out there, how you feel and who you are. With that kind of intimate material out there, do you feel like it is possible to kind of keep that air of mystery, or are you just more comfortable with that?
Both. I had a conversation with David Sedaris about this once, because he really lays everything out there. I mean, he wears, you know, his heart on his sleeve, and he writes these extended books about his real, true personal life, obviously filled with jokes. I agreed with what he said, and I'm going to probably mangle it entirely. But what he basically said when asked about this is that he's not revealing anything in a weird way, that reciting the facts or reciting the narrative of an experience or revealing intimate moments in your life, it feels and can feel, I think, very, well, intimate, I guess. It feels like you really know that person. And I certainly felt like I knew David Sedaris when I met him. But at the same time, as somebody who does that for a living, who puts all that stuff out there, I know that what you're left with as a viewer or as a reader is a very carefully cultivated narrative that I've created. It's not to say it's false, and it's not to say that I'm not being as sincere as I can be, or the jokes aren't true to the extent that any joke is true, but that you can't appreciate the entirety of somebody, or you can't appreciate the entirety of even the moment that they're talking about without having a real kind of intimacy with that person that you can't achieve through a book or through a film or through a stand-up performance. All any artist can do, I think, even when they want to be as forthcoming as possible, is edit those experiences to the best of their ability and hope that some part of it translates to a kind of shared experience that we all have, because ultimately that's what you're looking for. You're looking for a connection, not for a revelation about yourself.
Would you mind talking about Wet Hot American Summer?
Yes. No, what do you want to know?
I've been a fan of that movie for years. I really enjoyed the series about First Day of Camp, and I'm ecstatic to see that 10 years later is coming out. There's such an enormous amount of talent. The writing is phenomenal, and it's just such a fun premise, and I feel like it's one of those things where there's always a character that we could all relate to in a way, and I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on the experience.
Wet Hot's a really good example of comic camaraderie that a lot of people in my business really strive for, because it's really just about a bunch of people who like each other coming together and trying to make each other laugh, and it's really not much more complicated than that. So when we're showing up to do it, it's really just about trying to appeal to the sensibilities of the people that you're surrounding yourself with and hoping that there's a larger audience out there that will find the same things funny that you find funny.
There's at least me, so you got that.
So that's one.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. I feel great about that.
There's one more thing I wanted to touch upon, because I feel like you're one of these comedians that nowadays people are going to not just for the humor, but also to just get a reality check. I feel like you're helping us to digest what's going on in the world around us right now. Do you see it that way, or is it just a continuum of your work?
I think every comedian since this election has struggled with what is my role right now, because the American population, as best as I can tell, is very concerned. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican, I think we all feel the kind of world shifting under our feet a little bit. Maybe you like that, maybe you don't. But I have felt like my job is not to change anybody's mind, because I don't think it's possible. I'm not that good. But what I think I can do is make people feel like they're not crazy, to get on a stage and say, hey, this is all bananas. And if you feel like it's bananas, you're right. It's bananas. And try to do that with as much levity as I possibly can. And then the trick is, well, how do I do that in a way that is unique to me and isn't just kind of generic political comedy? And it's been a struggle. Gosh, your audience there in Milwaukee is going to be delighted to come see how I have resolved those questions for myself. I mean, this is a real cliffhanger moment for this interview. How will he do it? How will he manage to navigate this tricky political environment we are in a way that leaves us doubled over with laughter? I mean, you'll just have to come and see.
Michael Ian Black, thank you so much for your time today. We really look forward to seeing you this weekend in Milwaukee.
Me too. Now all I have to do is write an hour worth of material.
Hey, easy.
Thanks again. Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Comedian Michael Ian Black spoke with WUWM's Rachel Owens and Milwaukee Comedy's Matt Kemple. You can see Black reprising his role as McKinley in the second season of Wet Hot American Summer, which has just been released on Netflix.
You can also see him live at Turner Hall Ballroom Sunday night at 8 as he closes out the Milwaukee Comedy Festival. You can find the complete show information at WUWM.com.
This summer marks the 50th anniversary of the Milwaukee Riot of 1967. When Lake Effect Weekend returns, Radio Chipstone brings us the story of one man's experience of that incendiary time. You're listening to us on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Some say it's malice, some say it's a lot of nerve. Say we can't quit moving, we get what we deserve.
Lake Effect Weekend continues now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Matt Mixon was born in 1951, and he spent his formative years living in central Milwaukee. His family moved to the North Side when he was a teenager, and as he dealt with his own transition, the rest of Milwaukee was changing too. Racial tensions were high, and the city was on the brink of something big.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, contributor Jennifer Fields brings us the story of one young man's experience of the Milwaukee Riot of 1967.
In the 1960s, right around 63, my family moved to the far northwest side of Milwaukee, about three blocks north of Silver Spring Drive. It was a bit of culture shock, going from Robert Fulton Junior High to John Muir Junior High, and suddenly being one of just a handful of black kids in my school. Most of my friends, my old friends, still lived in the Central City. So I would often go back into the Central City to play basketball or just hang out with some of my buddies. But around that same time, the Black Panthers were making news. The nation was grappling with the struggle for civil rights. When I started to really notice things, I would say it was leading up, you know, late 66, going into 67, and I did have a part-time job on weekends working at a slot race car track on the corner of 9th and Burleigh, and it was a black-owned business. It was across the street from Tal's Cleaners. And it was kind of a weekend hangout for kids and teenagers. And I remember in July of 1967, when there were riots happening in Milwaukee. I remember standing on that corner, looking out the door of the slot race car track. And I saw a Jeep come down Burleigh. And it was just the strangest thing for me to watch a National Guard caravan, a mini caravan, coming down Burleigh. It just seemed so totally out of whack. When the rioting happened, much of the anger was directed at the businesses that were along 3rd Street. And I didn't see any of that firsthand, because by the time all of that started happening, I was back at home. As a teen, I didn't participate in marches and demonstrations. Living in on the northwest side, it was just not something that I could get away with. I always felt Milwaukee was a segregated city. Even when I lived in the Central City, I remember that Capitol Drive was kind of like the border. If you went beyond Capitol going north, you really didn't feel comfortable. I remember on one summer day, and I can't tell you the exact year, but I had gotten off the bus at 76 and Fond du Lac. There used to be an ice cream place on the corner there, and I had just enough money to buy that ice cream cone. And I'm licking the ice cream cone, and a convertible pulls up with some white teenagers in it, and they shouted some profanity at me, using that N-word. And I really wanted that ice cream. But I was angry. I was an angry young teen. And as the light turned green, I threw my ice cream cone and it landed inside their convertible. And I thought, okay, that's it. You know, that's my way of striking back. Come say it to my face, you know. You get big and bad and you huff and puff, but what are you going to do with it? I was not a bad kid. I didn't, you know, I was not a troublemaker. You know, things like that, I still remember. I think that broadcasting ignored us during those days. I can't say that any of the Milwaukee stations really went into the black community and dealt with some of the big structural issues of institutional racism. The struggle for civil rights, as far as media is concerned, was always a national story, unless something happened like the riots in 67 to get on the radar locally. Back in the 60s and the early 70s, local television stations did do documentaries, but I don't have any recollection of those being about the core community. As I think back about that time, going from 67 into 68, James Brown came out with a song, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and it became kind of an anthem for many black teens. I remember thinking, well, I always knew I was black. I always knew I was proud. But to hear those two things connected in a song, all of a sudden it was like a beacon went off for me. And I said, yeah, that's me, you know? And music was also changing the way we listened and the way we reacted. There were a sequence of songs that came out in those few years. I remember Sly and the Family Stone came out with Everyday People around that time, late 68. And then the Temptations came out with Psychedelic Shack in early 1970. And those were anthems and celebrations, and my community was never going to be quite the same again.
Material culture contributor Jonifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
Stick around. This week's Ex Fabula is up next on Lake Effect Weekend here on 89.7 WUWM.
Two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
Ex Fabula Radio Time on 89.7 WUWM. Good afternoon. I'm Bruce Winter with Leah Delaney, the Ex Fabula co-founder here in Milwaukee, and every week we have live stories for you taken from past events on a certain theme, and the theme this week is, as he throws it to Leah.
And we'll catch it and bobble it for a second while I explain why the theme is the theme, if you don't mind.
All right.
This week's theme is race and place. So as you know, Bruce, over the past couple of years, we have had a fellowship with Ex Fabula, dealing with race and privilege. And so the applications for the Season 9's fellowship are now available at exfabula.org/fellows. So with this year being the 50th anniversary of the fair housing marches in Milwaukee, we're focusing on the theme of race and place. So for example, those who might be interested in filling out an application and becoming a fellow might have stories of actual experiences during those housing marches back in 1967, 68, or they're trying to get access to housing today. Or maybe they have stories about what it is to drive in Milwaukee as a black person or a person of color. So along with those actual storytelling events that we're going to have with our fellows. We're also going to be having events centered around talking to kids about race again, and also race related to public health. There's going to be a lot to cover this year with our Exfabula fellows, so we're really encouraging everyone to apply to tell their story about race and place.
And everything is at exfabula.org.
You know it.
All right. First story for today.
Yeah, let's just jump right in. So again, we are talking about race and place. So our first story comes from our event, Only in Milwaukee Story Slam. Let's listen to Sue Blostein's story.
I moved to Milwaukee in 1979. I'd grown up in New York. I lived in Madison for 5 years, and I made it here. Tonight, I just went to an event before I came here. It was an open house from an organization that I have a really long history with, the Metropolitan Milwaukee Fair Housing Council. In 2017, we are going to celebrate, I believe, the 50th anniversary of the Federal Fair Housing Act. And my time in Milwaukee, a few years into my time in Milwaukee, I got to intersect with this interesting slice because Milwaukee has a very rich history in the area of fair housing. I had a really nice upper flat at 41st Street, just north of Hampton Avenue. It was an upper flat above the owners of the house. They were an elderly couple. I was a lot younger then. And it was a great place, great price, close to my work. I worked at W.H. Brady then. And the only thing was the landlord was really nosy. I don't know if that was just a Milwaukee phenomenon, but he was really nosy, very paternal, which I guess was nice. I would come and go. I worked second shift a lot of the time. But somehow he always managed to be at the back door when I was coming or going, oh, Susan, what are you doing? Oh, you worked overtime on Saturday. Yeah, I thought we saw you leave early. And I'm like, oh, my God. I was feeling a little smothered. But anyhow, nice apartment, good location. I kind of put up with it. Actually, I didn't live there right away. But anyhow, 1983, I started dating a black man, and he would come visit me. And they met. I introduced them to him, you know, because they're always at the back door when I'm going up. You know, and I have decent manners. Hi, you know, this is Maurice. He's a friend of mine. Oh, okay. Anyhow, on Mother's Day, this is great, on Mother's Day, he had spent the night before, and when he left in the morning, and then not long after that, my landlord said, Susan, can we talk to you? And I go downstairs. His wife had always been kind of on the quiet side. She says to me, are you running a cat house up there? I was like, whoa. And he said to me, you know, we can't have this, Susan. We have lots of nice things in this house. And I was like, okay. Now, I wasn't very strategic about working the law, so I jumped the gun and said, fine, I'm out of here. And I found another apartment, but I also had a lot of activist friends. I was an activist, and I knew about the Fair Housing Council. And I went to them, and I told them what happened. And they said, yeah, you have some recourse, even though it's an owner-occupied building. And there's a lot of details involved. I had to write up a narrative of what happened. They said, well, you sure to go back and discuss it with him because it's better if he actually evicts you. You kind of jumped the gun by, like, I'm out of here. But anyhow, to make a long story short, they did help me this is, what, 1983. They helped me recover some money from my moving expenses. And I became a volunteer investigator for them as a result of this. And that's a really wonderful way to learn that discrimination and racism doesn't always have that ugly, hateful face where they're just going to say, no, we don't rent to you people. But the things that I was told when I went to seek a unit, and the things that people of color were told when they presented similar income and other characteristics, the things that they were told about availability, it's like, okay, this has been laid bare, what goes on. And maybe not only in Milwaukee, but definitely a feature of life here. And at 40 years, they still shouldn't be having to pursue these things, but they're alive and kicking.
So that was Sue Blaustein's story that she told at her Story Slam, where the theme was only in Milwaukee.
And I think the theme we can take away from that story is that racism always isn't overt, loud, and in your face.
Indeed.
It can be very subtle at times.
So we're talking about Race in Place, which is revolving around our Ex Fabula Fellowship applications that are now available. And we'd also like to mention that we are kicking off our membership series again. So this is a really, really good time to apply for an Ex Fabula membership as well. So you can help us create programs such as the Ex Fabula Fellowship and other really great and groovy ways to support Ex Fabula. So, and you can get all of that information about the benefits at exfabula.org.
Great and groovy. I like that.
I'm all about alliteration, so.
After this next story, I want you to explain this nonprofit death match that's coming up next week.
Yeah, we'll do.
But first, though, let's do the next story.
Okay, great. So again, we're jumping back into stories about race and place. This next story is coming from an event we had with our fellowship series. It was called Creating a Welcoming Community in Bayview.
So when Gina called in early January, and she said, Antoine, we got a divorce, me and my husband, and you have to move out of your home. I knew that my love affair with Bayview was over. Inside, I actually felt that it was about a year overdue. I met Bayview at a young age. I grew up on the north side, and like LG, driving on the south side, it always seemed gloomy and cloudy. But for a Bayview girl I liked, that I married, I moved to Bayview. So I was 22, Bayview was about 120. And I lived roughly six blocks away. I was really excited to move here. We could see the Summerfest fireworks from our home. There were all these cool new places getting started. Central was here. My wife had been here. She's a lifelong Bayviewer, so she knew all about the Bayview Bash and Chill on the Hill on Tuesdays and all that cool jazz. And so I fell in love with Bayview, so much so that I decided to put a ring on her, and I literally lived on one street in three different houses for 7 years. I went from 2539 to 2539A to 2550. I love this place. I even took ownership and called myself the self-proclaimed King of Bayview. I would go to events with a Bayview, with a King of Bayview shirt on, and ask for my royal fees or any sort of gifts that they could give the king. And no one seemed to actually do it, but that was all right. That was all right. Going to places like South Shore, I really started to fall in love with Bayview. I even got to meet the other black guy in Bayview. We would meet him passing by at the gas station. And then I got a new job where I was working for a nonprofit, helping neighbors in need, helping neighbors who didn't have the same sort of life that I was living or who was starting to not find me relatable. And that started to tear inside of this young man trying to make a change, whose heart was in the north side, but whose home was in Bayview. And from that, I started to look at Bayview a little different. I lived next door to a church right around the corner on Howell. And I remember getting pulled over. He must have not knew I was the King of Bayview. And so he checks my tags and he checks my ID and everything checks out. And he says, hey, do you know such and such? I don't, is what I replied. And he continues with his day. Inside, as a black man, you kind of have this sense. I did know that guy. He was the other black guy. The police thought that because I was a black guy in Bayview, I would automatically know who the other one was. And then the honeymoon phase was over. And I started to look at Bayview and I started to go to the Stone and realize I was the only black guy there. Started going to Cafe Lulu and the Hi-Fi and realized there weren't a lot of people who looked like me. The only time I would get to see somebody who looked like me was at the Highbury for hip hop nights on Fridays. But in that growth, I've learned that that is okay. That is all right. Bayview is a place right now that may not be for me, but it's for other people and to each its own. A funny story was there was a young lady who became a good friend of ours because she saw us walking down the street and we were a black couple. And she immediately stopped us and said, oh my God, I need to get to know you guys. I haven't seen a black person all summer. Sad, but true. In all these stories, I still miss Bayview and I still come all the time. I come to Revel for hookah, still come to Highland for the Highbury, I apologize, for hip hop night. But what I actually find a little solace in is the ride back home. Thank you.
And that was Antoine Carter's story told at one of our fellowship events called Creating a Welcoming Community in Bayview.
And speaking of events, I kind of teased this going into that story, but I saw this and I went, what in the world is a nonprofit death match between Hunger Task Force and It's Fabulous? What?
I think you just said it. So on August 10th, Milwaukee Nonprofit Death Match is a trivia fundraiser that's going to be held at Brenner Brewing Company. So we're going to be squaring off against the Hunger Task Force, a worthy opponent and wonderful organization as well. And we're going to see whose team is the biggest know-it-all. So you can get details to that if you want to help us become the biggest smarties in Milwaukee, exfabula.org.
And if you want to pass along the stories on XFabula Radio, they are at WUWM.com. And we are here every weekend, right?
This is so true.
All right. We'll see you next week.
Great.
XFabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up our show today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned now for Weekend All Things Considered coming up next. It is 4 o'clock.
What you say?
I said he's good to me.